right. Thank you very much, Ross, for those comments, and thanks to all the speakers. It's my job to sort of run the panel, and I'll make a couple quick observations, and then other people can we can have some give and take. I want to say that at Creighton University, where I taught for 20 years from 1990 to 2010, I often had students in my freshman class who were surprised to discover that Creighton was a Catholic university. You mean this is a religious school? So this is to reinforce your point that I think it's absolutely correct. And I would say also that it's clear, I think it's quite right, that multiculturalism, political correctness, whatever we want to call the sort of fevered political utopianism, is clearly an ersatz first philosophy for the university. I saw this as a professor where we wanted to have diversity across the curriculum. And that's precisely the idea, right? Your first philosophy provides a rationale for the whole. It provides some account of what the university is trying to, what the end that it seeks. And so at a Catholic institution that had pretty strong core curriculum, but even there, the tendency was to reach towards political, it was a soft political practice. By no means was it toxic, but there was a tendency to go to some political project, moral political project, as the first philosophy for the university. And I would suggest that this is actually progressive Protestantism in its secular form, that I don't think Yale and Harvard have changed much at all religiously over the last 150 years, and that they were, in their own way, institutions that shifted Christianity from a kind of transcendent concern, which were people, elites, were having more and more difficulty believing that Jesus rose from the dead and other supernatural claims of Christianity. And so it was at places like Yale and Harvard that people theorized how it is that Christianity really is about transforming the world and bringing in the kingdom of God as a moral political project. And that after World War II, that came progressively secularized. And so I look at the leadership. I agree with you, the moralistic feminists are what I call post-Protestant WASPs. And it doesn't matter that they are Black or Hispanic, but that they are largely socialized by these formerly WASP institutions that were dominated by a kind of progressive, imminently oriented Protestantism. So I think it's interesting that there's a strong continuity. Not surprising, therefore, that Catholicism presents a particular, it sticks in the bone in the throat of these religious institutions, these secular institutions, because they're not actually really secular. They're post-Protestant WASP institutions. And so Paul Blanchard's, what was the title of the book? Catholicism, Freedom, American Freedom, and Catholic Power. You could probably tell a story about how the basic frame, the basic concerns remain the same, although the theological language has all fallen away. So I think that's very important. I think it speaks to Reinhold Hutter's opening lecture today, that if we don't, our hearts are restless until they find their rest in God. All of us have a natural desire for God. If we don't provide people with a sophisticated, open, intellectually flexible context with which to actually ask that question, what is my ultimate end, we're going to get these perverse and ersatz theologies. And it doesn't mean that people have to teach Karl Barth or Hans Urs von Balthasar, but I think these institutions won't find a kind of stability for that, I agree with you, that sort of 15% of students they won't be able to sort of stabilize the moral culture until they actually open up the curricular environment for more robust classes that engage metaphysical questions.
Well, I thought I would try to say just a few brief things. Really, I have a kind of preface, which might be kind of immediate response to something that Ross just mentioned, and then three points more generally about the conference as it's unfolded, trying to sort of summarize and present what I think is, something, some way forward, perhaps. Hopefully, just maybe 3 or 4 minutes. The first point about Catholic U and the Chronicle of Higher Education you brought up about whether basically is a robust Catholicism not going to sell in the current market. I mean, there's just there's enough places out there who do it. It's a niche market. You're not getting enough students. And Catholic U is experiencing this because enrollments are down and they're having budget troubles. I live across the street from Catholic U. I don't know the budget numbers or the enrollment numbers, but I suspect that this is not quite factually true. I think the Catholic U is actually one of the great examples of the way you can turn a large institution around. And they have begun quite successfully, I think, to turn it around. Now, that doesn't mean the work is done or that it can't still go wrong. But I think it's a very promising model. What happened there? You had the board of directors who were a board of trustees who were very firm. They consistently put in a president who really cared about the Catholicity of the school, and then very systematically, programmatically began examining the hiring and the curriculum to put the right people in. And yes, now on the bottom side, when you're talking about this from the student side looking up, that there's going to be a lag as you begin to attract the right kind of student or get the reputation for attracting the right kind of student. But I think it's a winning proposition. That's the first point about that. But I think my experience.
But wouldn't you say it's kind of post hoc ergo proctor hoc fallacy here, which is that I think all private institutions that are not super rich, and Catholic U is definitely not in the super rich category, they're all struggling they're all struggling for fee paying. Students. So the fact that Catholic U made these changes in terms of Catholic identity and that they have enrollment challenges, these may be completely unrelated. Or even more, it could be that they would have even worse enrollment problems if they hadn't made the changes.
Well, then I think the tone of the piece certainly suggests that it could be people who are unhappy with the president's leadership and so on are using these problems to sort of blame the Catholicity for the enrollment. That's totally possible.
That's right.
I still think there is a market.
Well, I think that's a fair point, but I would also suggest that, and this is based on my experience with the Thomistic Institute, where we're putting on academic events on a lot of different campuses, and I visited a lot of those campuses. I think, and it's also my experience as a Dominican priest, people are more formable by the truth than you might think. And if you, I mean, sometimes, okay, we have a priory, St. Mary's Priory and Church, which is effectively on the Yale campus. The Yale campus has grown around it, so now it's surrounded by all Yale buildings. We've had a long history of having Dominican priests there who were intimidated by the elite university professor and therefore have been reluctant to try to engage the university. And I think what we've come to discover is that even a very modest, Catholic priest has tremendous power to speak the truth and to change the people who listen to him, because he has something that not everybody who has a podium on campus has. And so you don't have to be extremely credentialed to be able to affect people by simply proposing the truth, because the truth has its own power and its own attraction. And I do think that a robust Catholic intellectual environment, if you can create one, it can become attractive or can change students. You change the market, in other words. Now, maybe there's a lot more that needs to be said, you know, to build that case. But that's what I'd say. Now, I had three quick things I wanted to say about the theme of our conference in general, which was the Catholic intellectual and the challenge of the contemporary university. Insofar as we have few true Newman-esque universities that are, you might say, robustly Catholic universities, as Dr. Hutter was portraying it, what should a Catholic intellectual do if he or she finds himself or herself at a podium in a contemporary university? Well, maybe first we could ask, what is the challenge of the contemporary university? I think we've heard from Dr. Dineen and also Dr. Hutter and just now from Ross about the challenges, just to kind of rapid-fire name them: disintegration of disciplines, strife and division on the campus, which may be related, the kind of what seems to be the victory of Nietzsche and Marx to claim that the intellectual life is instrumental in the service of the will to power or class struggle. In other words, everything is politics on the contemporary campus. There is simply nothing but politics in literature, in sociology, in theology even, in philosophy. A lack of meaning then for students. There's no class that tells you how to put it all together. And then deep internal contradictions, even within the beliefs that students themselves hold. I believe that neuroscience teaches me that everything, I have no freedom because it's all determined by the material conditions of my brain and chemical states and hormones and so forth. And at the same time, I have such a powerful freedom that I can reconfigure the reality of my own body and determine my body. These are actually totally incompatible views, often held by the same people. I think that's the challenge of the contemporary university. What is then a Catholic intellectual? Well, perhaps an intellectual who is Catholic. That's a minimal definition. An intellectual who can integrate his or her study into Catholicism. Or maybe it's the reverse. Maybe it's understanding how what I study is a part of this larger whole. That would be something more like what Dr. Hutter was suggesting Newman portrays. So then what can a Catholic intellectual do on the contemporary campus? Well, I think first be an interlocutor for lots of people who would be curious to know what the Catholic intellectual tradition has to say, and to do that in a intellectually responsible and open and friendly way. And I think that's exactly the sort of thing that you've been modeling for us. To be a witness to the tradition, to be a wisdom figure, to be an exemplar, I think especially of intellectual charity and practical charity. But also, if you're somebody like Dr. Eyre, I think showing forth a kind of serene wisdom and interior peace that suggests there's something deeper to what he's talking about than I have heard in another classroom. And that, I think, shows a kind of icon of how you can live as a serious intellectual who's also totally faithful. And I think there's great power in this, and we've seen it in bringing people like Carlos Eyre or Reinhard Hutter or Pat Dineen or Phil Munoz to Rusty Reno, to college campuses to speak. It's simply showing students that it's possible to be an intelligent person who is also profoundly faithful. And that is not what they presuppose. And once you have that idea, then in a way the sky's the limit.
I don't have much to add other than I really, the whole idea that the religion that used to be in place in all of these schools is still religion, but it's a different, mm-hmm. It's very, very perceptive mm-hmm. observation that belief is belief. Mm-hmm. And actually, for years now, I've been joking that the religion now in place at Yale has two foci, diversity and environment. Well, whatever. I don't know how it happened, but everyone on the faculty started receiving emails from the dean of the School of Forestry and Environmental Studies.
Right.
No other professional school dean has the emails go to the entire faculty. They may go to all the students, I don't know. But the whole idea that belief is belief, right? Even if the belief is not transcendent, it has the same social and political and economic function. Belief is belief. To the point that when you challenge that, right, let's say, not just as a Catholic, but as someone who doesn't agree with that status quo, when you challenge it, you run the risk of being the equivalent of a heretic, right? And of being silenced or marginalized in the way that heretics used to be. Because there are things that one cannot say that are not acceptable. So, in many ways, yeah, the belief functions the same way. What do we hear nowadays about acceptable and unacceptable speech? Right? It's the same that we used to hear 1300 or so. And later, too, about theological error. It's unacceptable. And we cannot allow it. That's the other thing. It cannot be allowed. Certain things cannot be spoken. And I'm constantly just amazed at this, that there are certain things one cannot say, not just as a Catholic, but as a dissenter. Being a Catholic in many ways is being a dissenter to begin with. But one does not have to be Catholic to get into trouble for saying the wrong thing nowadays in a university environment. And there's no discussion. And that's the other thing about heresy. There's no discussing a position that has already been branded as heretical. That was true back in the day when heretics were persecuted. It's true nowadays. It just cannot be put forward, and there cannot be a discussion about it. Case in point, can't remember the author's name, but he's at Princeton. He wrote a book on bigotry. Anyone know this book? The title of which is Bigotry. The argument of which is that only individuals on the right side of the political spectrum can be bigoted. That there is no bigotry on the left. The argument being the definition of conservative is a person who fears change, which I thought was a very odd definition of conservatism. Fearing change. So therefore, only...
Who wrote that book needs to be Edmund Waldstein, who would love to change things very dramatically and go back to the 13th century.
So we're, you know, in many ways trapped in the same syndrome.
Stan, so I can see folks. I don't have too much to add that hasn't been said already. I found all the talks today and yesterday very good. One of the themes that's been very apparent to me and something I've been thinking about is and that Ross brought out very nicely, I think, how persecutions for heresy are alive and well, and that our universities are far more religious than we think they are. I think the connections that secular really means sort of a post-Protestant is very amoralistic and puritanical movement. I think that's exactly right. I liked Ross's division into the sort of two purposes of the university, technocracy and post-Christian humanism. One correction, I think you missed something, and this is obviously because you went to Harvard. You forget excellence in athletics is a leading purpose of the university.
They still play football? I thought they got outlawed.
Yeah. So my first job was at North Carolina State University, the agricultural, you know, old land-grant university. And that is the technocrat. I mean, that's the purpose. Is, I think those universities, as long as they can get their budgets in order, will be fine because they can still offer what they offer, what they claim to offer. Right. I was, during faculty orientation at North Carolina State University, I was given, you know, huge university. I went to a very small liberal arts college of 850 people, and then I'm in this 35,000 person university, and I was assigned an orientation. They asked for your name, and then they wrote down a name badge. I was assigned to the Faculty of Poultry Science, which I thought was a joke, but then I realized, came to learn, it was one of the best departments within the University of North Carolina State. Yeah. Well, they know things and can produce things that are valuable. Then I went to Tufts University, which embodies sort of the post-Christian humanism, as it were. I lived on campus. I lived in a dormitory at Tufts University. And I loved being there. But I remember walking around late at one night. I told some of the other faculty this story. As my first year there, second year there, walking around late at night, and just walking the campus, and it was a nice campus, and you know, what is? I was teaching Aristotle's Politics at the time, Book One of the Politics. Every association has a purpose or end or telos, and I was asking, what is the purpose of Tufts University? I don't mean to pick on Tufts, but it's just where I was.
No, it's fine.
And, it was sort of immediately obvious. The purpose of Tufts University was sort of to perpetuate the oligarchic class, or in their own minds, the aristocratic class. It's where wealthy individuals who couldn't get into other schools on the Red Line came to meet their friends and spouses, right? And, you know, that's really why it existed. And that was, you know, it was sort of very disillusioning to me to, like, you know, you want to feel connected to the institution that you're at. You want to give yourself to the institution. So I realized at that very moment I couldn't. But it made teaching there very interesting, because I was teaching Aristotle, and the students, I would just gravitate to reading Aristotle's Ethics or Plato's Republic or anything when you actually set forth the idea that there was something real and tangible and important and ancient truths that could change your life. If you taught those books seriously, you would find students coming to you. Right? When it came out that I was sort of a Catholic, believing Catholic and conservative at Tufts, you know, I'd have students because it was like going to the zoo, you know, like, oh, look at that, a conservative. Yeah. But the students there were so hungry, right? And I see the moralistic side. I think this is what Ross was bringing out. There's a deep hunger among young students. So connect this one more thing. So what about the Catholic University? I mean, what the Catholic University should be. I mean, the nation needs, the world needs Catholic universities now more than ever. I mean, if the Catholic University can't get its act in order, no university will. I mean, we'll still have the vocational universities. They'll be fine in a way. But I think Professor Dineen was right when he said, you know, right now might be 2006 in terms of the universities. You know, the university as we know it, I just can't, at the end of my career, I can't believe it's going to exist. Because organizations that have no reason for being will commit suicide in one way or the other. Right? So I don't know how it's going to come about, but I just think we're going to see radical change in our university systems. I think it's unsustainable. Where we're at. I mean, there's only so much entertainment and so much managerial training that people are willing to pay for. And that's where I think the opportunity comes up. Because when everything comes crashing down, there's still going to be a hunger, not everyone, but lots of people are hungry to understand the truth of things. And if that's rooted in human nature, as I think it were, that's the reason for the university. Right? And when everything comes crashing down, we have to be ready to build it back up, or as it were. So that's what I see as the task of the Catholic intellectual regarding the university, right? Retaining the understanding of what a university is, right, through the first two talks today, and then doing what really the Thomistic Institute is doing, what we're trying to do at Notre Dame, carving out space, whether within the university or outside the university, where the traditional liberal arts are maintained, right? You have to keep the project alive, the understanding of what a university really is. Keep it alive somewhere in the university, so when everything else comes crashing down, it can be reasserted. Right? And that's supposed to be optimistic. I know that it is. And that, I think, is also the reason for this conference, right? So my third university was Notre Dame. where I thought it would be, like, finally I'd be at a university where, you know, the university knows what it's about. There are great things. I'm not one of those critics who think Notre Dame is so, you know, is gone. It's, you know, we're not Jesuit. I mean, we're. but the reason to go to Notre Dame is actually because if we can't save Notre Dame, it will be awful. We have to save it. But Notre Dame itself doesn't quite know what it's about anymore. And so we need conferences like this and speakers like the individuals who spoke today to be thinking through these questions. And with good fortune, we'll have a dean or provost or president who listens to the Thomistic Institute website, and we'll save the university that way.
Any panel members want to pipe in?
I mean, it might not come crashing down.
I'm inclined to think it won't.
Yeah, well, we're both, you know, we're the stagnationists.
No, but
the collapsitarians.
But if you go over to the medical school at Yale, that's not on the verge of collapse.
Right.
I mean, there's tons of money coursing through that system, and if you go up on Science Hill at Yale, I think people in the humanities have a false view of actually the university. You know, we're in a declining industry, and the people in the who are part of the technocratic project are by and large doing fine. I mean, it works. They have willing students, as you pointed out. The majority of students are, some of them kind of think, my God, this is really kind of soulless, but they conform. I don't see our society backing off from spending very large sums of money to prepare people to participate in the information-driven post-industrial economy. So I reject the idea that, you know, tuition crisis,
I think
some institutions are going to wind up.
I mean, I think on the margins, there are schools, you know, schools that are sort of on the bubble.
Yeah.
You know, especially as, you know, the sort of millennial bulge works its way through the system, and suddenly you just have many fewer students sort of to go to all these different schools. There will be schools that have falling enrollment and schools that collapse and so on. But among the sort of, you know, I mean, we're the Thomistic Institute is sort of effectively a chaplaincy to elite schools in many ways. And if we're talking about elite schools, you know, NYU is going to be fine, right? The schools at the top are likely to be fine. What is collapsing are the humanities in certain ways. In terms of, and again, it's a long-term decline in many cases, going back decades, which is why people have been, you know, if you get up and talk about the crisis of the humanities, people say, oh, we've been hearing about the crisis of the humanities since the 50s. But that's because it's been going on since the 50s. You know, but I mean, that in that sense, I think in certain ways, you could usefully think of, you know, the project of the Catholic intellectual at the modern university is to sort of, create the thing that replaces the humanities, right? And then if you're creating that thing, then eventually you also create the thing that can remoralize the technocracy. But that's sort of the longer-term project. But in many ways, you know, if the Thomistic Institute or anybody else are doing their work well, they're providing a place where people can sort of practice the liberal arts in a Catholic context in a way that they aren't able to in these departments that are pinwheeling back and forth between abstruse hyper-specialization and theory and sort of total political engagement. But I think the overarching, you know, for the big rich schools, they're, you know, the top of the U.S. News and World Report rankings, if society holds steady, that's sort of the larger question, but assuming society holds steady over the next 50 years, I would guess that the top of the U.S. News and World Report rankings would look depressingly similar in 2058 as it does today.
Is that because of the wealth? I mean, it's just Harvard can't mess up because it has $35 billion or whatever.
No, I just think it's we live in a complex technological society, and we have to have institutions that both sort people as to who's capable of for what role, and I think higher ed is a massive human resources department for corporate America, and we have to have people who have the technical skills to actually do these many things. So I just don't see, if we're spending, you know, 12% of our GDP on higher education or whatever it is, or 8% or 7%, I don't see that changing. I actually see it increasing, probably, in the next 50 years. What the change is that the university will not exist anymore, where the university is, you know, medieval creation of a faculty-governed society. So it's a society of scholars that organizes its own common life towards the end of the pursuit of knowledge. And that's already pretty much gone. I think at a place like Yale, faculty still have veto power. If the faculty were to have some vote of no confidence in the president, that would be very... But you've basically given up your you've alienated most American... My friends in Great Britain, the Oxford and Cambridge, they're very jealous of American scholars because American scholars don't have to run anything. Whereas at Oxford and Cambridge, you still have to run the colleges, the faculty do it. So even the rich schools won't be universities. They will be bureaucratic, technocratic institutions administered along the same principles as Google and, a department of the United States government, with variation. Some will be more nimble and flexible and humane. Others will be more immobile and inhumane to the people who work there. That's what I foresee. And I would add too, I think that Roger Scruton's helped me see that you cannot have the humanities in a culture that is very, that makes it egalitarianism a priority, because cultural competence and fluency it has to do. I mean, if you didn't take, well, you know, the rebellion against Latin and Greek, and is that you, it used to be in Great Britain that was a proxy for being a gentleman and a well-educated person, but you can't do that because if you don't have access to the kinds of schools that teach you Latin and Greek, then you're, you know, so some miner's son who went to a state school in the 1950s couldn't compete. So you have to get rid of Latin and Greek as a center for your educational system if you want to be egalitarian. You also got to get rid of English, got to get rid of history, because those are things that people who are native speakers, that are born and raised, if you will, in the center of our culture, are more competent and fluent in those disciplines.
But in what sense is technocracy egalitarian? Aren't
equal opportunity?
But that's only theoretical. I mean, in practice, the technocracy is the like you said. I mean, it's what Tufts, right? It's the reproduction of elites. Mm-hmm. And I don't know. I mean, it seems to me that maybe Scruton is right that you have to get rid of things that sort of make it too overt. Latin and Greek make it too overt, so you can have sort of secondary codes.
Yes.
But you know, I mean, I was just in Southern California, and we were in Venice Beach, and there's Abbot Kinney Boulevard or Avenue or something is like the main artery in Venice Beach, and we walked down it at night to get ice cream from the fancy boutique ice cream place, and to walk along that street, it's, you know, restaurant after restaurant after fashionable store after fashionable store. There's nothing, nothing remotely egalitarian. If you took sort of the random person from the state school and you dropped them into the world of the people in those bars and the people going to those restaurants with their complex farm-to-table menus and so on, and, I mean, they would be as at sea as the student from the Highland Scotland dropped into Oxford in 1897 or something. I mean, it doesn't seem to me that diversity and egalitarianism are different, right? The commitment to diversity
I think democratic cultures, egalitarianism has two sides to it. One is individually oriented and the other is collective. The collective one has to do with representation. And so you want to see yourself represented. So you feel like the country is more equal if people like you are rich and if people like you are exercising power in Washington, D.C. And so the South Boston Irishman feels that something about the American promise was realized when John Kennedy was elected president of the United States. Even though, good grief, the kid was, you know, the guy was born to a super rich father and da da da, nothing. But that's just, Rousseau saw that. He recognized that there's a way in which we identify. And so I think.
But isn't diversity an ideology of empire, not an ideology of democracy? It seems like the diversity is
Reinhardt.
Yeah.
I only want to observe that the last factor that makes people love me besides talk of politics.
Right.
Seems like an American disease. Can we elevate the discussion, please?
Yeah. All right. Well, maybe we can get questions about Carlos Ayer.
Yeah. Well, I was going to say that some subjects just will not go away because they can be politicized. Literature, history, you name it. Any subject in the humanities can be politicized, and it is a disease.
Not every subject. No.
But well, I think this is a good. Well, I think metaphysics has more promise.
I've seen it done.
metaphysics is actually very deracinated. I mean, it's more like mathematics than it is like English literature. And in that sense, it does hold out. So I think it could be something that if you want to run Harvard or Yale as a global institution and you don't want to turn a distinctively Western thing into the center of a university, actually metaphysics is a more open, because it participates in universality in such an immediate way.
Can I just, I can't help but defend metaphysics for a moment and say, I think metaphysics is in a certain sense like literature and not mathematics, in the sense that, yes, they involve abstraction. Dr. Huger was referring to the levels of abstraction. But I think to be good in metaphysics, you don't want to just memorize the propositional, you know, statements.
Right.
Like we described.
Have to. Yeah.
Because that just gives you – that's learning it like mathematics.
Yes. Yeah.
But in fact, it's supposed to be a grasp of being, and that is very deep. And it requires being – perceptive.
Don't underestimate mathematics.
Okay, all right. No, but mathematics is able, you're able to abstract, mathematics works with a kind of, you try to diminish your perception of the complexity in order simply to isolate the quantity, and then you manipulate the quantities. And certain minds are very apt to do that, but they may not be very perceptive in other domains of their lives. I've met people like this. Maybe you have. But metaphysics, I think, is actually calls you, you get better with age, according to Aristotle and metaphysics, because you grow in your grasp of the real around you, and you need to be more sensitive to reality in order to be good at metaphysics. So anyway, that
can I
yeah.
Ask a no. I want to get away from metaphysics. So I want people's opinion on there are all these stories. I think the state university in Wisconsin. I don't remember which one. I think it was Wisconsin. Is announced it was getting rid of its English department or history department.
Stevens Point, yeah. University of Wisconsin.
Yeah, several humanities departments. It was just getting rid of them and replacing them with more technical things. And the stories in Chronicle of Education, you know, how terrible this is for the liberal arts and everything. And I read this story, and I was like, I'm not supposed to say this as, you know, a partisan of liberal arts. Is it so bad that this, because I don't know anything about this school, but I'm only guessing what the English department is like, right? And most English departments, most history departments, most political science departments, would it be so bad if we just got rid of them?
So it's the Munoz euthanasia solution to political correctness.
I'm just trying to push the conversation. But from a practical standpoint, reforming the humanities to be the actual humanities from within seems impossible. And is it so bad that these things get, I mean, they're not actually the humanities right now. Should we be so worried when a state like Wisconsin or a college president says, stuff is useless anyways? Right? Is that such a tragedy right now?
I think we should push for, you know, required philosophy for high school seniors. When I taught and I had these international baccalaureate students, when they started coming on stream in the aughts, they were really just able to could move through the levels of abstraction, and they also had, you know, some basic philosophy of science, and they could distinguish between the different kinds of claims that one could make and the standards of proof and all that kind of stuff. So,
but if you required a philosophy class in high school, can you imagine what they'd be actually taught?
Well, you can't
in most places.
You can't let the perfect be an enemy of the good. I mean, do we want to consign every American who doesn't have the luxury of going to one of the few classical schools to a life with no exposure to the possibility of higher things? Or do we want to take the risk that maybe only 10% will get exposed, or 25%, because most of the teachers will be, well, frankly, incompetent rather than ideologically driven? And my view is I think we should, you know, take those kinds of risks. And
I mean, you could tell, I guess, probably from my remarks, but my inclination is that as much as you might, you know, think that postmodernism in all its various forms is empty and destructive and so on, the texts themselves are still there, even if your professor is performing some horrible thoracic surgery on it. And they're still in their mere existence and sort of the possible exposure to them, there's still a sense, you know, a student can sort of half by accident have an encounter with real literature or real philosophy in that context. Whereas, you know, the sort of pure, I mean, I don't know, I'm partially sympathetic insofar as there is a sense in which I think technical schools should be technical schools, and that I mean there is an argument that, you know, you want to do what you're competent at. And there was a piece that when I worked for The Atlantic many years ago, we ran a piece called In the Basement of the Ivory Tower, and it was by an adjunct professor who was basically teaching kids who had an English requirement at one of these schools where they were there for technical reasons. It was the most depressing piece you can imagine, basically. And so in that sense, I'm sympathetic. Mm-hmm. But I also think that, you know, to let the technocratic paradigm win. If you say, oh, postmodernism has destroyed the humanities, mm-hmm. so just let them go.
But your point was that won't happen, because the technocracy has to have a moral purpose, and they'll just grab whatever's available.
They'll grab the moral. But it's better for the technocracy. I mean, I don't know. Like, I'd rather have a technocracy that, you know, needs to pay lip service to egalitarianism and anti-racism than a technocracy that's pure. Like, I think people who consider themselves religious conservatives should be more afraid than we are of what pure technocracy looks like.
Reinhard?
I don't know how it fits in, but I would love to bring up a topic that is we haven't discussed. It's called poverty. Mm-hmm. Not the poverty of students, but the poverty of university professors from early on. John Henry Newman wasn't married. That wasn't because he didn't want to before he became a Catholic priest, of course. But because as a tutor in any one of the colleges in Cambridge or Oxford, you weren't expected to be married, because you only got a tutorial fee. You got a stipend on which you could not marry someone.
It was prohibited to be married and be a tutor.
But those
it wasn't
things
until
were
the
you
early
had to
20th
get,
century
you had
that
to
you could
get
be
a living,
tutor.
Yes, you had to get a living by becoming a pastor, a parish, and you got a living. You didn't have a living. You could be head of college, and you had, and then you could be married. You were head. Most when you look at medieval Paris, when you look at the whole tradition, Kant couldn't afford to be married as a professor in Königsberg because he was paid by student per head. If you had 20 students in your class, your philosophy class, you couldn't live on much. So it was only in Germany, for example, that the university professors became part of the middle class and an established sense of the upper middle class when the government of the Wilhelmine Empire decided to make the university tools of the empire. And then you became an ordinarius, but you bought into the system. You got a lot of time for research. You can even still organize the university internally. But you became part of a national project, and you were expected to operate. Yeah. And this is why Adolf von Harnack and the others, of course, as good university professors, signed the war effort of the emperor. This was not, these things were leaked. That continued in the Weimar Republic, that continued in Nazi Germany, continued after the war. The state and the university were linked in many ways, and the professors liked it because they could afford to have families, they had very fine salaries, they had free time. In the American system, it was in the 1960s when you had the transition where the administration bought out the professors in a certain way. The administration took care of the student unrest. They had their own managerial and political ways to do it. Professors were incompetent. They even had maybe some radical ideas. You send them to the library, give them great salaries, give them sabbaticals, and take them away from the university power. And they accepted the deal, broadly speaking, with few exceptions. And so we have a connection here. I mean, traditionally, intellectuals, Aristotle, Socrates, none of them were rich people. In Greece, the big money makers were like nowadays the sportsmen, the ones who played the Olympics, then ran for the Olympics. They had outrageous incomes in Rome, but even in ancient Greece, they were wealthy. The intellectuals, so to speak, who went to the Lyceum or the, they were not. And they were single most often, not always. And so we need to look at that also. Our own expectations nowadays as intellectuals in the humanities, the assumptions of careers, what kind of salaries connected. So I'm just throwing it out. I'm not having a solution, but this is part of the picture somehow. The poverty and the seeking of truth were somehow seen together. It was voluntary poverty, not an imposed one. And nowadays the picture has changed, and we see ourselves in complete, also often in mercurial terms, and the intellectual life is a career option. At least a semi-career, not a full one. It's nothing compared to the stock market. And one can be asked, why is one actually picking up such a comparatively poor vocation? Right. But actually, it is a form of a life of poverty. And some of my colleagues at CUA can surely give witness to that. The salary range at CUA put people into voluntary poverty in a certain way. But these days, of course, this is seen as an imposition, as an inability of the university often to care for its people.
But right. Socrates did propose a state salary, but it didn't work out too well for him.
Yeah. But I think that there.
So you tell me.
We all know. I mean, certainly I do. In my people, professors that I admired, and there's a kind of chasing after appointments, fellowships, and chairs. Right, where your research topics, the things you say, it's become much more extreme, you are shaped to move ahead in the system. And we all knew people who didn't do that, right? That they had a kind of purity of heart when it came to the things that they cared about and what they thought was important, what they thought needed to be said. And that's to accept. And there's a certain blessed are the poor in spirit. Now they got their university salaries, and in no sense were they poor by American standards, but I do think there it needs to be a true intellectual has to exercise a lot of spiritual discipline. What is it? Sertelange says in one of the things that the intellectual is likely to be hated by the world, and when he's loved, he's destroyed too, because you're the system brings you in. So you always have to be, I think, aware of that and the seductions of both honor and wealth.
Yeah. Well, and the assumption in Catholicism, of course, was that the role of it was still more explicit, right? That, that they sort of, when you think about sort of Catholic intellectual life before the last 50 or 60 years, it's dominated by priests, and that's sort of I think the Catholic corollary of the point you're making, except it's more overt and obvious. And this gets into sort of issues in secondary education, which are probably beyond the scope of this conference, but are sort of referenced here and there. But what the disappearance of the Catholic school that instills a robust Catholic identity is, it's very hard to separate that from the collapse in religious vocations. What's causing what, is a matter for sociologists of religion to unpack. But in the end, if you aren't offering Catholic students constant access to models of at least a certain kind of renunciation, then both there's a limit to sort of the credibility of both the religious witness and the intellectual witness too.
Our session is set to end in 5 minutes, and we haven't yet gotten to any questions from the audience. Okay. Well.
Okay. Well, you're shunning.
Deneen. Yeah. No, I want Deneen. I want Deneen, but I also want everything.
This fellow
we
here.
Have 5 minutes.
Yep.
Yeah.
So I took a philosophy class in high school, and I can tell you what we did. We read Henry David Thoreau and we watched the movie Advantage. But say it was much better. Say that we read
Vantage Point is about, it's like the military attack in Latin America, and it's like four separate perspectives.
Right.
Sorry.
I think we might have watched, I don't know, The Matrix, too. Say it was much better.
Say it's Plato.
Real philosophy.
Good man.
You're still getting things that are not Catholic truth. Why are we selling ourselves short? I mean, there was this huge pop stoicism. But a starving man, I mean, students are starving for this stuff. But a starving man does not discriminate between McDonald's and a steak dinner. He'll take anything that they can latch onto. And we can say things like, let the universities do their technocratic function. But one of the first pieces, actually, I think the first piece I ever read for Ross was called Our Reckless Meritocracy, probably about 5 or 6 years ago. And he points out the story of John Corzine, who was a very successful meritocrat. But he's not successful. We get the financial crisis. We get the Iraq War. We have the past 4 or 5 presidents, all highly educated. We have our Supreme Court of, I don't know, all Yale and Harvard degrees. We get Planned Parenthood v. Casey. It's not fulfilling the function that we can expect it to fulfill. Why are we selling ourselves short of really doing the Catholic function? Another thing that Ross said was that we could imagine all the Jesuit universities can work back to a Catholic message, and it would satisfy the 10% of the United States Catholics who care. But aren't we already seeing this in the past 50 years with, as Patrick mentioned, the Franciscan University of Steubenville, Christendom College, Thomas Aquinas College, and there is that niche, and they are preaching that truth. But for the rest of it, I'm kind of with Phil. Why do we care when it dies? It's not even fulfilling the functions it's supposed to.
We go to Patrick.
Patrick Deneen?
I've been reading this book by a New York Times columnist about the church.
I thought it was a post.
I was wondering whether Ross or anyone would have some reflections on what you talk about, what you're talking about in that book, its implications for Catholic higher education. We've been talking about this thing called Catholicism that seems to me that seems to be evidently, in certain respects, let's say, in the process of undergoing certain questions, and how this kind of robust Catholicism that we've been talking about today is, in some way, is or is not likely to be manifest as a kind of a hope for the transformation or redefinition of Catholic universities at a time where there seems to be a kind of loss of confidence of where the center is within Catholicism itself. If I were coming to conference and not knowing what's going on out there in the world, I would say, wow, this Catholic thing sounds great. But in fact, right now...
You're an eccentric, then.
Yeah. Right. Well, I say this in part because I actually just gave a lecture at Notre Dame campus on that book, and one of the things that I talked about was the fact that places like Harvard, you have an extraordinary uniformity of worldview. You have, they know what they're about. There's not the kind of internal disagreement about what Harvard is about on the faculty and even on our student body. Whereas at Notre Dame today, which purportedly is a Catholic university, which should give us some degree of uniformity about what we believe, there's a pretty low-level and sometimes high-level ferocity of disagreement that goes on within the Catholic faculty and beyond. Administration. So it seems to me that we've been talking a lot about the challenge of secularism, to Catholicism, but it seems to me that one thing we really haven't talked much about is the deep divisions right now within Catholicism and how that poses a special challenge for Catholic education, Catholic education, and beyond. Not that anyone wants to rip on that, but... Ross,
I guess me? yeah, I mean, the reality is... trying to think of a way to link the two questions a little bit. But, you know, Catholicism is a very strange thing, sort of seen from the outside or the inside, for that matter. one of the things I've been going around, you know, promoting a book about the Pope, which has been interesting in many ways. But one thing that it's, you know, that's sort of clear is that, yeah, there's no sort of coherent, stable idea of what Catholicism is in the West. Or around the world generally, but let's sort of stick with the West because we're talking about sort of Western secular liberalism. And that's a big problem. And, you know, it's the interesting thing about the Francis Pontificate is that at one level, his sort of public rhetoric and writings and so on offers a kind of more direct even than John Paul II or Benedict critique of technocracy, mm-hmm. right? If you read Laudato Si, it's very, I mean, you know, it has obviously a sort of environmentalist frame that fits with what the Yale School of Forestry and so on believes about the proper approach to, you know, ecological regulation. But it's also just a sort of, I mean, it's, you know, there are passages in that I kind of just transposed into that column about John Corzine that are just about how terrible and feckless and stupid, you know, elites are and greedy and so on down a list of sort of papal epithets and so on. And that's part of what Francis is doing and saying. And so in a sense, there is in the Francis Pontificate this message that you could grasp onto if you wanted to say, look, we're just presenting Catholicism in full. We're presenting Catholicism as the alternative to your system. And I think I disagree a little bit about. I don't think Harvard knows. I think there's sort of a surface level agreement about what Harvard is for, but I think at a fundamental level there's just total uncertainty and incoherence in there. And I think, you know, you would probably agree with that too. That in sort of internal to liberalism, you know, if you get below the level of these sort of formal, we're all for diversity commitments, the liberal worldview just doesn't make any sense anymore. It's just this mishmash of sort of leftover metaphysical premises from Christianity, a little scientific materialism over here. I mean, it's not a coherent system. And in that sense, you could say, look, yeah, I mean, here's Catholicism, which for all its sort of, you know, doubts and difficulties here and there, is a coherent alternative to a system in crisis. And part of what the Pope is doing sort of presents Catholicism in that light. But then another very important part of what the Pope is doing is, you know, and giving effective ammunition to people within the Catholic Church who believe in a model of sort of the Catholic University and the Church itself as one that is effectively a kind of chaplaincy to the spirit of the age. And this is clearest on issues related to human sexuality and marriage and so on, but whether the Pope himself fully intends this or not, in his appointments and sort of the people around him, the implications that the media draws from his rhetoric and so on, you know, it's a vision of Catholicism that is a sort of, you know, it's this school of forestry plus Christianity. It's the sort of, you know, it's a narrative in which the church is sort of at peace with, you know, late modern bourgeois life. And since we have this ongoing intense struggle over Catholic identity within Catholic universities and all across the West, having a Pope who appears to be on the side of accommodation makes the project of holding up Catholicism in full seem much, much more difficult. You know, and I mean, there's a lot of, it's hard to tell. I mean, one of the things about promoting the book is you realize how little normal people, and by normal people, I mean normal Catholics, not sort of lapsed Catholics, but just, you know, people who go to church and read the news and sort of are well-informed, how little they are focused on or care about these abstract and abstruse debates in Rome. And, you know, at a certain level, that's reasonable, and it's sort of, you can overdraw from you know, from reading your Twitter feed and sort of following intellectual debate, sort of how much import this has in certain ways. But then in other ways, you know, I sort of raised this idea in passing of this 10% who sort of, you know, are the people who want, you know, who really want meaning, right? And it's a challenge for a Catholic university because it needs more than just that 10%. But at the same time, where that 10% goes does ultimately determine the direction of all of these institutions. And that's true within Catholicism, too. There's a, you know, the percentage of Catholics who care about these specific debates around the Francis Pontificate is relatively small, but they're the people who are going to be making the decisions that determine what kind of culture Catholicism is going to be in 50 or 75 or 100 years. And in that sense, you know, it's hard for me to see, as someone who, for all of my own doubts and difficulties, wants Catholicism to be a real alternative to the society that we currently inhabit, it's hard to see this papacy as anything but a sort of, you know, with at the practical level, a sustained series of blows to that project. And it makes me doubtful, you know, there's a style of Catholic intellectual engagement with this papacy that just wants to talk about the sort of anti-modernist element in Laudato Si, and to say, you know, well, this is the real Francis and the other stuff is just Roman politics. But I think that's completely wrong. And I think that from the point of view of the future of the Catholic University and the future role that Catholicism plays in the life of the West, it's the practical changes that the Pope has made and continues to make that are going to sort of, you know, their effects or how they're resisted or turned back is what's going to be determinative and dispositive for the future. And anyway, this is just a long pitch for my book, so I'll try. that's sort of my answer.
You know, we really have to, we're over time, and I want to draw our session to a close, especially with a thanks for all of our speakers this afternoon. So please join me in thanking them. And thank you for coming.